Edius Perik Zion, Mishnah Test 7-9, the last of the Perik, and here we have 4 points of testimony delivered by, according to our Mishnah, Rabbi Nechunya ben Gudgada. This also appears in Maseches Gittin, the fifth Perik, Mishnah Hey, and there it's Rabbi Yochanan ben Gudgada, which that's probably the correct Girsa. In any case, he's going to testify about four things here. Two have to do essentially with divorce and marriage, and that's the first two, if you will, and the second two have to do with stealing things, if you will. Okay, so here we go. The first of the four cases has to do with marriage and divorce, contrasting them. So when it comes to kiddushin, affecting the first stage of marriage, so since that's a kinyan, that's a transaction whereby the wife transfers her marriage rights in exchange for, let's say, the ring, so she needs to be a legal person, she needs to have das. If she lacks das, the legal standard which understands the consequences of her actions, so then she's not capable of effecting, you know, legal transactions, and therefore one who lacks das cannot, amongst other things, cannot get married, cannot do kiddushin. Nevertheless, you could have a situation which a girl or a woman doesn't have das, and yet she could be married midoraisa, and that is because when she's a katana or a nara, when she's younger, up to 12 and a half, so her father could act on her behalf. So you have an 11-year-old girl, and let's say this girl is even what's called a chareshet, a deaf-mute. She can't speak, she can't hear. So such a person, if they can't speak and can't hear, is considered to have no das, lack das, and therefore can't effect transactions, which would be the case of this 11-year-old chareshet, this girl who's deaf-mute, but her father could accept the kedushin on her behalf. He takes the ring, she gets married, and therefore she could be married midoraisa, even though she herself doesn't have any das, because there's a workaround like I described before. When it comes to divorce, gerushin, that's affected by the husband delivering the get into the hand or the equivalent of his wife. That doesn't really require her das. She just has to receive the get, and as long as she understands this means they're quits and she's not going to keep on coming back, like a puppy dog would. You obviously can't tell your dog to go away, he's going to keep it coming back. But if a person who has the sensibility to understand this is a divorce and they shouldn't come back, even if they lack the legal level of mental development called das, still they're eligible for a divorce. And therefore, Mishnah will point out that you could have a chareshet who could be married thanks to her father, and she's married midoraisa, and she could be divorced because her husband can simply give her the get, and since she has enough, we presume that she doesn't have legal das to effect other transactions, she has enough sensibility, even if not das, to understand that her husband is saying, you know, goodbye and don't come back. And therefore, him delivering the get to her would be, yes, an effective divorce, which could sever a doraisa marriage. That's the first part of the Mishnah. Inside it says, Heid Rabbi Nechunya ben Gudgada al ha-chareshet. He testified regarding the deaf-mute woman, Shehisiya Avia, that was married off on a doraisa level to her husband by virtue of her father acting on her behalf and receiving the kedushin. Shehi yotza beget, that she still can, yes, be divorced under normal circumstances by means of being delivered a get. Of course, again, if she lacks even the sensibility to understand that this means don't come back, she keeps coming back again and again or whatever, she won't be divorced, but that's not because she's a chareshet per se. That's the first case of the four. The second one has to do with a girl who's married on a rabbinic level only, that she is allowed to eat truma even if her father's not a kohen, if her husband's a kohen. So the backstory is as follows. When it comes to truma, only a kohen can eat it. One is considered to be a zara. A non-kohen can't eat it. Once a woman marries a kohen, she's considered part of his household. And just the same way the other members of his household, like his children and even his slaves, can eat truma, like by virtue of him being able to eat truma, so can she. So the point here is that if a woman is only married on a rabbinic level, meaning on a derais level, she's not married, still will let her eat truma in her husband's home. We can't let her eat truma deraisa, that's forbidden by the Torah, but we could let her eat truma, that's only truma midrabanan, whatever that would mean. Okay, whatever that would be. So the chiddush of the Mishnah really is that the woman who's married on a rabbinic level can eat rabbinic truma, and we don't say, no, she's liable to come to accidentally eat real truma deraisa and be over the isser. Okay, we don't say that. So what's the backstory? How does a girl become rabbinically married? So the answer is, if her father dies, leaving her as an orphan, and she's not old enough to accept kedushin on her own, she's still a minor, less than 12, so then The rabbis empowered her brother, who's a bar mitzvah age, or her mother, to marry her off, accepting kedushin on her behalf. Okay, so this is really for the benefit of the girl, and if later on she decides that she's been paired up with a bad guy, she can be mima enet, she can reject him and be unmarried. But the point is that the mother could act in a way that could to marry her off rabbinically. And that's what happened in our case over here. Okay, so I'm just going to make the simple point which I told you a moment ago. I'll read you the words inside because you should get kind of your pencil out, so to speak. There's a lot of words that aren't explicit in the Mishnah to understand it. And then the second part of the Mishnah will say that a woman who's married on a rabbinic level, so if she predeceases her husband, she dies before her husband, so then her husband inherits her. Okay, now normally a husband inherits a wife. That's the Pashas Deraisa, but actually she does that at the Smidur Rabbanan. But either way, a husband definitely inherits his wife. But here we're saying this is a marriage which is rabbinic in nature. So that means on a Deraisa level, if this young girl dies, so maybe you'd have two people claiming her estate. Let's call it her brother and her husband. Let's call those two people the two sides of the story. Okay. So it could be other people as well, of course, but let's say call it the brother and the husband. So if on a Deraisa level it's entitled to the brother, the question is, well, how in the world could the rabbi say, no, give it to the husband instead? The answer is the rabbis have a power called Hefker Bezdin Hefker. The Bezdin is authorized to declare any property ownerless, and from there they can sort of award this ownerless property to whomever they want. So the situation here would be that the rabbis are saying a girl who's married on a rabbinic level, should she predecease her husband? So the rabbis declared her assets ownerless, and then they can be transferred on to her husband directly, and that's straightforward. And that's what the Mishnah says as well. So this third case inside, says the Mishnah, that Rabbi Nechunya ben Gudgala testified about, was Val Katana Bas Yisrael. If you have a girl who's not 12 years old, whose father's not a Kohen, Shenisses LeKohen, who gets married to a Kohen on a rabbinic level, meaning through her mother, Shehi Ocheles Betruma, that she's allowed to eat the Truma that she gets from her husband, again, Truma on a rabbinic level, rabbinic Truma only, Ve'im Mesa, and if she should die before him, Ba'ala Yorsha, then her husband inherits her, like I said. Okay, the fourth and final case here has to do with what's called Takanas Hashavim, a rabbinic enactment to make it easier to do tshuva. Because here's the situation. When a person steals, did I lose count here? I'm sorry. That was the second. This is the third out of four. I apologize if I lost count. So Takana Shavim works like this. The rabbis are concerned, listen, the Torah says if a person steals something, so the pasuk specifies that veheshev es gazela sher gazal, the robber has to return the thing that he stole. Now, what that means is as long as the thing that was stolen is still extant, is still around, so the thief has to give it back, as is, okay? If he sold it on, or if it's been broken, or if it's been changed, or it's something new altogether, so then he can't give it back. Instead, he'll give back just the value of what he stole. But if it still exists, he has to give it as it is. So, that would mean, if I steal your piece of lumber and I turn it into a canoe, so then if I want to do tshuva, I don't have to give back the canoe, because it's now a canoe, not a piece of lumber. I'll just give you the value of the lumber that I stole, okay? But what happens if I take that very beam that I stole from the piece of lumber and I build it in as like the support beam in my house, right? So it's like it's one of the rafters of my ceiling. And now I want to do tshuva and give you back and make do right by you. So for me to give you back the very beam that's there in my ceiling, I'd have to disassemble the whole house and take it down, which is obviously a big expense, and I'm not going to do it. So to kind of shove him, the enactment that made it easier to do tshuva is that the rabbi said, listen, even if the beam is still extant as is, and technically midoraisa it has to be given as is, but to do so would require a significant loss, like because you have to disassemble the whole house. So the rabbi said, no, you don't have to give back the actual beam, you can give back the value instead to make it easier for people to do tshuva. That's the story outside. Inside the Mishnah says, again, this is case 3 of 4, Va'al ha-marish, when it comes to like a beam built into the roof, like a rafter, ha-gazul, that was stolen, so that's a stolen beam, she-banu babira, that was built into a person's mansion, she-yiten es-damav, that one need not disassemble the whole house to get that beam out, to give it back to the original owner, rather he can pay back just the value of the beam that he stole, and that will make it, okay for everybody. That's the best case scenario as far as the rabbis are concerned. That's the takana. Takana is the shavim. Okay. The last of the four cases here has to do with a stolen animal, which the thief then consecrates and offers as a chatas offering. So what happens is a person has to bring a chatas, so he brings that goat and he gives it to the Kohen, and then the Kohen would eat it after he offers it. Now, if it's an illegitimate korban, it's not really an offering, so then the person, then really it's not allowed to be slaughtered in the temple courtyard, and it certainly can't be eaten. And the concern was that if the Kohanim are suspicious that this guy stole the animal that they were given to offer as his chatas, so then they won't do it. They won't do it. They're not going to eat this, you know, I'll call it treif, so to speak, animal, which is he's calling a chatas, but they think it's illegitimate, therefore it can't be slaughtered, can't be eaten. So therefore, as the rabbi said, listen, we don't want that to happen. How are we going to make everyone calm and the Kohanim go about doing their business as they're supposed to? We will say, listen, if a person steals an animal and offers it as a chatas, so then don't worry about it. It's fine. He doesn't need to bring another one. We're done with the story. That's the rabbinic position. The thought is by doing that, so then the Kohanim will say, okay, so if it means it's done and it's good, then we'll do what we have to do and, you know, fine. Now, that's the idea. The question is, behind the scenes, what does that mean? What does the rabbis do? How do they... If the thief doesn't own the animal, it's stolen, so then he can't really consecrate it, and he can't really give it as a chatas for himself, and it can't work as a chatas. So some Rishonim learn, it's ambiguous what the bartender holds, some Rishonim learn that it means that really, of course it doesn't work, of course everything is not okay, and of course the person still should bring his chatas, but the rabbi says, no, don't do that. They're relying on the power of the rabbi to make a rabbinic enactment of stopping this with Shev Altasa, just saying don't do it, and that's that. And so they're going to, rabbi said, listen, we want to calm everybody, so we say this is the one and only chatas to be brought, and therefore people will stay calm. There are other Rishonim will learn, especially because the Mishnah will say it's Mechaperes, it does atone. So they'll learn that actually this really does work, and it's really a legitimate, bona fide, effective chatas. And therefore, when the Kohanim eat it, it really is 100% okay. And nothing to worry about. So how could that possibly work if it's a stolen chatas? How could it be legit? So again, like the Rashma and others, that the way the mechanism would be is, again, Hefker, Bezin, Hefker. That the Bezin says, listen, it's true this is a stolen animal, but we will declare it ownerless, Hefker, so that when the thief consecrates it as a chatas, it will be effective as his chatas, and therefore it'll be an effective korban. And although that's obviously, he's a thief and he's a bad guy and this whole thing is disgusting, Hashem's not very impressed at all, he's rather disgusted with the whole process, still, that will prevent the Kohanim from having the problem, therefore they won't hesitate to offer people's chatos, and they'll eat it and everything will be a-okay, and the base image will operate as it should operate. Now all this, of course, assumes that no one knows, it's like a secret, that it's a stolen animal. If it's public knowledge, meaning three or more people know that this is a stolen animal, then it doesn't work. This whole thing doesn't work, okay? So, but if it's a secretly stolen animal, it would work, as I described a moment ago. And of course, we're talking about things like a chata, specifically where the Kohanim are eating it. But an ola, for example, which is burned in the Mizbeach and no Kohanim eating it, it wouldn't be the case. So there was no thought that the rabbis would say that an ola that's stolen and offered is effective for anything? No, not at all. But the chata is different because we're afraid that the Kohanim won't do their job if they think that this person can't be trusted and therefore will have a big problem. So that's called tikkun hamizbeach. This idea is we want to, again, a takana, once again, it's rabbis make enactments where we think this is, we have to choose between the lesser of two evils and the lesser of two evils. And this takana is let the Beis HaMikdash operate properly, no one being suspicious, no Kohanim being suspicious of, you know, stolen object, therefore refusing to do their work. Okay. The Mishnah says inside, "Val hachatas hagzula," and the stolen chatas animal shalon noda l'rabim, that was not publicly known to be stolen, meaning fewer than three people knew it was stolen. No one knows it was stolen; it's a secret essentially. So then, shehi mechaperes, that it's effective. Either it's literally effective, if you understand that it's like the hefker best in hefker, or it doesn't actually. It's not really effective, but we treat it as if it were effective, meaning there's no second one to be brought. Telling the kohanim everything's a-okay, so they don't get nervous. Mipnei tikkun hamizbeach, for the sake of literally tikkun hamizbeach, for rectifying the altar, literally. But it means so that the mizbeach will function as it should, and the Kohanim will participate without resisting, without hesitating, to bring people's karbanos, even people who they don't necessarily trust.